and off with him, and out trying to walk straight. Boozed at 5 o'clock. Night he was near being lagged, only Paddy Leonard knew the bobby. 14A. Blind to the world, up in a she-bean in Bride Street, after closing time. Fornicating with 2 shawls and a bully on guard, drinking porter out of teacups, and calling himself a Frenchie for the shawls, Joseph Manuo, and talking against the Catholic religion, and he serving Mass in Adam and Eve's when he was young, with his eyes shut, who wrote the New Testament and the Old Testament, and hugging and smugging, and the 2 shawls killed with the laughing, picking his pockets, the bloody fool, and he spilling porter all over the bed, and the 2 shawls screeching laughing at one another. How is your testament? Have you got an Old Testament? Only Paddy was passing there, I tell you what. Then see him of a Sunday with his little concubine of a wife, and she wagging her tail up the aisle of the chapel with her patent boots on her, no less, and her violets, nice as pie, doing the little lady, Jack Mooney's sister, and the old prostitute of a mother procuring rooms to street couples. Gob, Jack made him toe the line. Told him if he didn't patch up the pot, Jesus, he'd kick the shite out of him. So Terry brought the 3 pints. Here, says Joe, doing the honours. Here, citizen. Slán leat, says he. Fortune, Joe, says I. Good health, citizen. Gob, he had his mouth halfway down the tumbler already. Want a small fortune to keep him in drinks. Who is the long fellow running for the mayoralty, Alf? Says Joe. Friend of yours, says Alf. Nannan, says Joe. The member. I won't mention any names, says Alf. I thought so, says Joe. I saw him up at that meeting now with William Field, MP, the cattle traders. Hairy Iopas, says the citizen. That exploded volcano, the darling of all countries and the idol of his own. So Joe starts telling the citizen about the foot and mouth disease and the cattle traders and taking action in the matter, and the citizen sending them all to the right about, and Bloom coming out with his sheep dip for the scab and a hoost wrench for coughing calves and the guaranteed remedy for timber tongue. Because he was up one time in a knacker's yard, walking about with his book and pencil, here's me head and me heels are coming, till Joe Cuff gave him the order of the boot for giving lip to a grazier. Mr. Know-all, teach your grandmother how to milk ducks. Pissa Burke was telling me in the hotel, the wife used to be in rivers of tears sometimes with Mrs. O'Dowd, crying her eyes out with her 8 inches of fat all over her. Couldn't loosen her farting strings, but old Codsoy was waltzing around her, showing her how to do it. What's your programme today? Aye, humane methods. Because the poor animals suffer, and experts say, and the best-known remedy that doesn't cause pain to the animal, and on the sore spot administer gently. Gob, he'd have a soft hand under a hen. Gag, gag, garra, cluk, cluk, cluk. Black Liz is our hen. She lays eggs for us. When she lays her egg, she is so glad. Garra, cluk, cluk, cluk. Then comes good Uncle Leo. He puts his hand under Black Liz and takes her fresh egg. Gag, 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 garra, cluk, cluk, cluk. Anyhow, says Joe, Field and Nanetti are going over tonight to London to ask about it on the floor of the House of Commons. Are you sure? Says Bloom. The councillor is going. I wanted to see him, as it happens. Well, he's going off by the mail boat, says Joe. Tonight? That's too bad, says Bloom. I want it particularly. Perhaps only Mr. Field is going. I couldn't phone. No. You're sure? Nannan's going too, says Joe. The League told him to ask a question tomorrow about the Commissioner of Police forbidding Irish games in the park. What do you think of that, citizen? The slough and the hern. Mr. Cowconacre, Multifarnham, Nationalist. Arising out of the question of my honourable friend, the member for Shillelagh, may I ask the right honourable gentleman whether the government has issued orders that these animals shall be slaughtered, though no medical evidence is forthcoming as to their pathological condition? Mr. Allfours, Tam O'Shanter, Conservative. Honourable members are already in possession of the evidence produced before a committee of the whole House. I feel I cannot usefully add anything to that. The answer to the honourable member's question is in the affirmative. Mr. O'Reilly O'Reilly, Montanotti, Nationalist. Have similar orders been issued for the slaughter of human animals who dare to play Irish games in the Phoenix Park? Mr. Allfours. The answer is in the negative. Mr. Cowconacre. Has the Right Honourable Gentleman's famous Mitchelstown telegram inspired the policy of gentlemen on the Treasury bench? Oh, Mr. Allfours. I must have notice of that question. Mr. Stalewit, Buncombe, Independent. Don't hesitate to shoot. Ironical opposition cheers. The Speaker. Order, order. The House rises. Cheers. There's the man, says Joe, that made the Gaelic sports revival. There he is, sitting there. The man that got away, James Stevens. The champion of all Ireland at putting the 16-pound shot. What was your best throw, citizen? No, Bucklish, says the citizen, letting on to be modest. There was a time I was as good as the next fella, anyhow. Put it there, citizen, says Joe. You were, and a bloody sight better. Is that really a fact? Says Alf. Yes, says Bloom. That's well known. Did you not know that? So off they started about Irish sports and Shoneen games the like of lawn tennis and about hurley and putting the stone and racy of the soil and building up a nation once again and all to that. And, of course, Bloom had to have his say, too, about if a fella had a rower's heart, violent exercise was bad. I declare to me, Antimacassar, if you took up a straw from the bloody floor, and if you said to Bloom, look at Bloom, do you see that straw? That's a straw. Declare to my aunt, he'd talk about it for an hour, so he would, and talk steady. A most interesting discussion took place in the ancient hall of Brian O'Kiernoins in Sroid na Breatán Beag, under the auspices of Slua na Héireann, on the revival of ancient Gaelic sports and the importance of physical culture, as understood in ancient Greece and ancient Rome and ancient Ireland, for the development of the race. The venerable president of the noble order was in the chair, and the attendance was of large dimensions. After an instructive discourse by the chairman, a magnificent oration eloquently and forcibly expressed, a most interesting and instructive discussion of the usual high standard of excellence ensued as to the desirability of the revivability of the ancient games and sports of our ancient pan-Celtic forefathers. The well-known and highly respected worker in the cause of our old tongue, Mr. Joseph McCarthy Hines, made an eloquent appeal for the resuscitation of the ancient Gaelic sports and pastimes, practised morning and evening by Finn McCool, as calculated to revive the best traditions of manly strength and prowess handed down to us from ancient ages. L. Bloom, who met with a mixed reception of applause and hisses, having espoused the negative, The vocalist chairman brought the discussion to a close in response to repeated requests and hearty plaudits from all parts of the bumper house by a remarkably noteworthy rendering of the immortal Thomas Osborne Davis's evergreen verses, happily too familiar to need recalling here, A Nation Once Again, in the execution of which the veteran patriot champion may be said without fear of contradiction to have fairly excelled himself. The Irish Caruso Garibaldi was in superlative form, and his stentorian notes were heard to the greatest advantage in the time-honoured anthem sung as only our citizen can sing it. His superb high-class vocalism, which by its super quality greatly enhanced his already international reputation, was vociferously applauded by the large audience, among which were to be noticed many prominent members of the clergy, as well as representatives of the press and the bar and the other learned professions. The proceedings then terminated. Amongst the clergy present were the Very Reverend William Delaney, S.J., LLD, the Right Reverend Gerald Molloy, D.D., the Reverend P.J. Kavanagh, C.S.S.P., the Reverend T. Waters, C.C., the Reverend John M. Ivers, P.P., the Reverend P.J. Cleary, O.S.F., the Reverend L.J. Hickey, O.P., the Very Reverend Father Nicholas, O.S.F.C., the Very Reverend B. Gorman, O.D.C., the Reverend T. Maher, S.J., the Very Reverend James Murphy, S.J., the Reverend John Lavery, V.F., the Very Reverend William Doherty, D.D., the Reverend Peter Fagan, O.M., the Reverend T. Brangan, O.S.A., the Reverend J. Flavin, C.C., the Reverend M. A. Hackett, C.C., the Reverend W. Hurley, C.C., the Right Reverend Monsignor McManus, V.G., the Reverend B. R. Slattery, O.M.I., the Very Reverend M. D. Scally, P.P., the Reverend F. T. Purcell, O.P., the Very Reverend Timothy Cannon Gorman, P.P., the Reverend J. Flanagan, C.C. The laity included P. Fay, T. Quirk, etc., etc. "Talking about violent exercise," says Alf, "were you at the Keogh Bennett match?" "No," says Joe. "I heard so-and-so made a cool 100 quid over it," says Alf. "Who?" "Blazers," says Joe. And says Bloom, "What I meant about tennis, for example, is the agility and training the eye." "Aye, blazes," says Alf. He let out that Myler was on the beer to run up the odds, and he's swatting all the time. "We know him," says the citizen, "the traitor's son. We know what put English gold in his pocket." "True for you," says Joe. And Bloom cuts in again about lawn tennis and the circulation of the blood, asking Alf, "Now, don't you think, Bergen?" "Myler dusted the floor with him," says Alf. "Heenan and Sayers was only a bloody fool to it. Handed him the father and mother of a beating. See the little kipper not up to his navel and the big fella swiping. God, he gave him one last puck in the wind. Queensberry rules and all. Made him puke what he never ate." It was a historic and a hefty battle when Myler and Percy were scheduled to don the gloves for the purse of 50 sovereigns. Handicapped as he was by lack of poundage, Dublin's pet lamb made up for it by superlative skill in ringcraft. The final bout of fireworks was a gruelling for both champions. The welterweight sergeant major had tapped some lively claret in the previous mix-up, during which Keogh had been receiver general of rights and lefts, the artilleryman putting in some neat work on the pet's nose, and Myler came on looking groggy. The soldier got to business, leading off with a powerful left jab, to which the Irish gladiator retaliated by shooting out a stiff one, flush to the point of Bennett's jaw. The red coat ducked, but the Dubliner lifted him with a left hook, the body punch being a fine one. The men came to handy grips. Myler quickly became busy and got his man under, the bout ending with the bulkier man on the ropes, Myler punishing him. The Englishman, whose right eye was nearly closed, took his corner, where he was liberally drenched with water, and when the bell went, came on gamey and brimful of pluck, confident of knocking out the fistic Eblenite in jig time. It was a fight to a finish, and the best man for it. The two fought like tigers, and excitement ran fever high. The referee twice cautioned Pucking Percy for holding, but the pet was tricky, and his footwork a treat to watch. After a brisk exchange of courtesies, during which a smart uppercut of the military man brought blood freely from his opponent's mouth, the lamb suddenly waded in all over his man, and landed a terrific left to battling Bennett's stomach, flooring him flat. It was a knockout clean and clever. Amid tense expectation, the Portobello bruiser was being counted out when Bennett's second, Ole Fotz Wetstein, threw in the towel, and the Santry boy was declared victor to the frenzied cheers of the public, who broke through the ring ropes and fairly mobbed him with delight.
"He knows which side his bread is buttered," says Alf. "I hear he's running a concert tour now, up in the north."
"He is," says Joe, "isn't he?"
"Who?" says Bloom. "Ah, yes, that's quite true. Yes, a kind of summer tour, you see. Just a holiday."
"Mrs. B is the bright particular star, isn't she?" says Joe.
"My wife?" says Bloom. "She's singing, yes. I think it will be a success, too. He's an excellent man to organise. Excellent."
"Ho, ho, be gob," says I to myself, says I. "That explains the milk in the coconut and absence of hair on the animal's chest.
Blazes, doing the tootle on the flute. Concert tour. Dirty Dan, the Dodger son off Island Bridge, that sold the same horses twice over to the government to fight the Boers. Old what-what. I called about the poor and water rate, Mr. Boylan."
"You what?"
"The water rate, Mr. Boylan."
"You what-what?"
"That's the bucko that'll organise her, take my tip, twixt me and you, Caderiche."
Pride of Calpe's Rocky Mount, the raven-haired daughter of Tweedy. There grew she to peerless beauty, where loquat and almond scent the air. The gardens of Alameda knew her step, the garths of olives knew and bowed. The chaste spouse of Leopold is she, Marion of the bountiful bosoms. And lo, there entered one of the clan of the O'Malloys, a comely hero of white face, yet withal somewhat ruddy, His Majesty's counsel learned in the law, and with him the prince and heir of the noble line of Lambert.
"Hello, Ned."
"Hello, Alf."
"Hello, Jack."
"Hello, Joe."
"God save you," says the citizen.
"Save you kindly," says J.J.
"What'll it be, Ned?"
"Half one," says Ned.
So J.J. ordered the drinks.
"Were you round at the court?" says Joe.
"Yes," says J.J.
"He'll square that, Ned," says he.
"Hope so," says Ned.
Now what were those two at? J.J. getting him off the grand jury list, and the other give him a leg over the stile. With his name in stubs, playing cards, hobnobbing with flash toffs with a swank glass in their eye,
a drinking fizz, and he half smothered in writs and garnish he orders, pawning his gold watch in Cummins of Francis Street, where no one would know him, in the private office when I was there with Pisser releasing his boots out of the pop. "What's your name, sir?"
"Dunn," says he. "Aye, and Dunn," says I. "Gob, he'll come home by Weeping Cross one of those days, I'm thinking."
"Did you see that bloody lunatic Breen round there?" says Alf.
"U.P. up."
"Yes," says J.J. "Looking for a private detective?" "Aye," says Ned. "And he wanted, right go wrong, to address the court. Only Corny Kelleher got round him, telling him to get the handwriting examined first."
£10,000, says Alf, laughing. "God, I give anything to hear him before a judge and jury."
"Was it you did it, Alf?" says Joe.
"The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you, Jimmy Johnson."
"Me," says Alf.
"Don't cast your nasturtiums on my character."
"Whatever statement you make," says Joe, "will be taken down in evidence against you."
"Of course an action would lie," says J.J. "It implies that he is not compos mentis."
U.P. up.
"Compos your eye," says Alf, laughing. "Do you know that he's balmy? Look at his head. Do you know that some mornings he has to get his hat on with a shoehorn?"
"Yes," says J.J., "but the truth of a libel is no defence to an indictment for publishing it, in the eyes of the law."
"Ha ha, Alf," says Joe.
"Still," says Bloom, "on account of the poor woman, I mean his wife."
"Pity about her," says the citizen, "or any other woman marries a half and half."
"How half and half?" says Bloom. "Do you mean he..."
"Half and half, I mean," says the citizen. "A fellow that's neither fish nor flesh."
"Nor good red herring," says Joe.
"That what's I mean," says the citizen. "A pishogue, if you know what that is."
Be gob, I saw there was trouble coming. And Bloom explaining he meant on account of it being cruel for the wife having to go round after the old stuttering fool. Cruelty to animals, so it is, to let that bloody poverty-stricken Breen out on grass, with his beard out-tripping him, bringing down the rain, and she with her nose cock-a-hoop after she married him, because a cousin of his old fella's was pew-opener to the Pope. Picture of him on the wall, with his smash-all Sweeney's moustaches, the Signor Breeny from Summerhill, the Italiano, Papal Zouave to the Holy Father, has left the quay and gone to Moss Street. And who was he, tell us? A nobody. 2 pair back and passages at 7 shillings a week, and he covered with all kinds of breastplates, bidding defiance to the world.
"And moreover," says J.J., "a postcard is publication. It was held to be sufficient evidence of malice in the test case Sadgrove versus Hole. In my opinion, an action might lie."
6 and 8pence, please. Who wants your opinion? Let's drink our pints in peace. Gob, we won't be let even do that much itself.
"Well, good health, Jack," says Ned.
"Good health, Ned," says J.J.
"There he is again," says Joe.
"Where?" says Alf.
"And be gob, there he was, passing the door with his books under his oxter, and the wife beside him, and Corny Kelleher with his wall eye looking in as they went past, talking to him like a father, trying to sell him a second-hand coffin."
"How did that Canada swindle case go off?" says Joe.
"Remanded," says J.J.
"One of the bottlenose fraternity it was went by the name of James Wart, alias Sapphiro, alias Spark and Spyro, put an ad in the papers saying he'd give a passage to Canada for 20 bob. What? Do you see any green in the white of my eye? Course it was a bloody Barney. What? Swindled them all. Skibbies and buttocks from the County Meath. Aye, and his own kidney too. JJ was telling us there was an ancient Hebrew, Zaretsky or something, weeping in the witness box with his hat on him, swearing by the holy Moses he was stuck for 2 quid. Who tried the case? Says Joe. Recorder, says Ned. Poor old Sir Frederick, says Alf. You can cod him up to the two eyes. Heart as big as a lion, says Ned. Tell him a tale of woe about arrears of rent and a sick wife and a squad of kids, and faith he'll dissolve in tears on the bench. Aye, says Alf. Reuben J. was bloody lucky he didn't clap him in the dock the other day for suing poor little Gumley that's minding stones for the corporation there near Buttbridge. And he starts taking off the old recorder, letting on to cry. A most scandalous thing, this poor hard-working man. How many children? 10, did you say? Yes, your worship, and my wife has the typhoid. And the wife with typhoid fever. Scandalous. Leave the court immediately, sir. No, sir, I'll make no order for payment. How dare you, sir, come up before me and ask me to make an order. A poor, hard-working, industrious man. I dismiss the case. And whereas on the 16th day of the month of the Ox-Eyed Goddess, and in the 3rd week after the feast day of the Holy and Undivided Trinity, the Daughter of the Skies, the Virgin Moon being then in her 1st quarter, it came to pass that those learned judges repaired them to the halls of law. There Master Courtney, sitting in his own chamber, gave his rede, and Master Justice Andrews, sitting without a jury in the probate court, weighed well and pondered the claim of the first chargeant upon the property in the matter of the will propounded and final testamentary disposition in re the real and personal estate of the late lamented Jacob Halliday, vintner, deceased, versus Livingstone, an infant of unsound mind, and another. And to the solemn court of Green Street there came Sir Frederick the Falconer, and he sat in there about the hour of 5 o'clock to administer the law of the Brehons at the commission for all that and those parts to be holden in and for the county of the city of Dublin. And there sat with him the high synedrum of the 12 tribes of Iar. For every tribe one man, of the tribe of Patrick, and of the tribe of Hugh, and of the tribe of Owen, and of the tribe of Con, and of the tribe of Oscar, and of the tribe of Fergus, and of the tribe of Finn, and of the tribe of Dermot, and of the tribe of Cormac, and of the tribe of Kevin, and of the tribe of Caelte, and of the tribe of Ushian, there being in all 12 good men and true. And he conjured them by him who died on Rood, that they should well and truly try and true deliverance make in the issue joined between their sovereign lord the king and the prisoner at the bar, and true verdict give according to the evidence, so help them God, and kiss the book. And they rose in their seats, those 12 of Iar, and they swore by the name of him who is from everlasting that they would do his rightwiseness. And straightway the minions of the law led forth from their dungeon keep one whom the sleuth-hounds of justice had apprehended in consequence of information received. And they shackled him hand and foot, and would take of him ne bail, ne main prize, but preferred a charge against him, for he was a malefactor. "Those are nice things," says the citizen, "coming over here to Ireland, filling the country with bugs." So Bloom lets on he heard nothing, and he starts talking with Joe.
telling him he needn't trouble about that little matter till the first, but if he would just say a word to Mr. Crawford. And so Joe swore high and holy by this and by that, he'd do the devil and all. "Because, you see," says Bloom, "for an advertisement you must have repetition. That's the whole secret."
"Rely on me," says Joe.
"Swindling the peasants," says the citizen, "and the poor of Ireland. We want no more strangers in our house."
"Oh, I'm sure that will be all right, Hines," says Bloom. "It's just that Keys, you see..."
"Consider that done," says Joe.
"Very kind of you," says Bloom.
"The strangers," says the citizen. "Our own fault. We let them come in. We brought them in. The adulteress and her paramour brought the Saxon robbers here."
"Decree nisi," says J.J. And Bloom, letting on to be awfully deeply interested in nothing, espied his web in the corner behind the barrel, and the citizen scowling after him, and the old dog at his feet looking up to know who to bite and when.
"A dishonoured wife," says the citizen. "That's what's the cause of all our misfortunes."
"And here she is," says Alf, that was giggling over the Police Gazette with Terry on the counter, "in all her war paint."
"Give us a squint at her," says I.
And what was it? Only one of the smutty Yankee pictures Terry borrows off Corny Kelleher. Secrets for enlarging your private parts. Misconduct of Society Belle. Norman W. Tupper, wealthy Chicago contractor, finds pretty but faithless wife in lap of Officer Taylor. Bell in her bloomers misconducting herself, and her fancy man feeling for her tickles, and Norman W. Tupper bouncing in with his pea shooter just in time to be late after she doing the trick of the loop with Officer Taylor.
"Oh, Jaker's Jenny," says Joe. "How short your shirt is."
"There's hair, Joe," says I.
"Get a queer old tail end of corned beef off that one, what?"
So anyhow, in came John Wise Nolan and Lenehan with him, with a face on him as long as a late breakfast.
"Well," says the citizen, "what's the latest from the scene of action? What did those tinkers in the City Hall at their caucus meeting decide about the Irish language?"
O'Nolan, clad in shining armour, low bending, made obeisance to the puissant and high and mighty chief of all Erin, and did him to wit of that which had befallen, how that the grave elders of the most obedient city, second of the realm, had met them in the Thalsel, and there, after due prayers to the gods who dwell in ether supernal, had taken solemn counsel, whereby they might, if so be it might be, bring once more into honour among mortal men the winged speech of the sea-divided gale.
"It's on the march," says the citizen. "To hell with the bloody brutal Sassenachs and their patois."
So J.J. puts in a word, doing the toff about one story was good till you heard another, and blinking facts and the Nelson policy, putting your blind eye to the telescope, and drawing up a bill of attainder to impeach a nation, and Bloom trying to back him up, moderation and botheration and their colonies and their civilization.
"Their civilization, you mean," says the citizen. "To hell with them. The curse of a good-for-nothing god lights sideways on the bloody thick-lugged sons of whores gets. No music and no art and no literature worthy of the name. Any civilization they have, they stole from us. Tongue-tied sons of bastards' ghosts."
"The European family," says J.J.
"They're not European," says the citizen. "I was in Europe with Kevin Egan of Paris. You wouldn't see a trace of them or their language anywhere in Europe, except in a Cabernet de Sens. And, says John Wise, full many a flower is born to blush unseen. And, says Lenehan, that knows a bit of the lingo, conspue les Anglais, perfide Albion. He said, and then lifted he in his rude, great, brawny, strengthy hands, the medder of dark, strong, foamy ale, and uttering his tribal slogan, Lov Darug Abu, he drank to the undoing of his foes, a race of mighty, valorous heroes, rulers of the waves, who sit on thrones of alabaster, silent as the deathless gods. "What's up with you?" says I to Lenehan. "You look like a fella that had lost a bob and found a tanner." "Gold cup," says he. "Who won, Mr. Lenehan?" says Terry. "Throw away," says he. "At 20-1, a rank outsider, and the rest nowhere." "And Bass's mare," says Terry. "Still running," says he. "We're all in a cart. Boylan plunged £2 on my tip scepter for himself and a lady friend." "I had half a crown myself," says Terry, "on Zinfandel that Mr. Flynn gave me. Lord Howard de Walden's."
20-1, says Lenehan. "Such is life in an outhouse. Throw away," says he, takes the biscuit, and talking about bunions, "frailty, thy name is Sceptre."
So he went over to the biscuit tin Bob Doran left, to see if there was anything he could lift on the nod. The old cur after him, backing his luck with his mangy snout up. Old Mother Hubbard went to the cupboard. "Not there, my child," says he. "Keep your pecker up," says Joe. "She'd have won the money only for the other dog." And J.J. and the citizen arguing about law and history, with Bloom sticking in an odd word. "Some people," says Bloom, "can see the mote in her's eyes, but they can't sense beam in their own."
"Raw, my mate," says citizen. "There's no one as blind as the that won't see, if you know what that means. Where are our missing 20 million Irish here today instead of 4? Our stribes. And our otters and textiles, the finest in the whole world. And our old wool, the sole old home in the time of him of Vinyl. And our fks, our musk from the Lizabantrum, and our lick lace, fortunaries, and our white flit glass down by a Bailey Bock, our Huguenot plin, that have since Jacadilly. And our Oxford tweed and ivory point from the Camacom Convent in Ross. Nothing like it in the whole wide world.
Where are the Greek merchants that came through the Pillars of Hercules? The Gibraltar now grabbed by the foe of mankind, with gold and Tyrian purple to sell in Wexford at the Fair of Carmen. Read Tacitus and Ptolemy, even Giraldus Cambrensis. Wine, peltries, Connemara marble, silver from Tipperary, second to none. Our far-famed horses, even today, the Irish hobbies, with King Philip of Spain offering to pay customs duties for the right to fish in our waters. What do the Yellow Johns of Anglia owe us for our ruined trade and our ruined hearts? And the beds of the Barrow and Shannon they won't deepen with millions of acres of marsh and bog to make us all die of consumption.
As treeless as Portugal will be soon, says John Wise, or Heligoland with its one tree. If something is not done to reafforest the land, larches, firs, all the trees of the conifer family are going fast. I was reading a report of Lord Castletown's.
Save them,
says the citizen, the giant Ash of Galway, and the chieftain Elm of Kildare, with a 40-foot bole and an acre of foliage. Save the trees of Ireland for the future men of Ireland on the fair hills of Eire, oh.
Europe has its eyes on you, says Lenehan.
The fashionable international world attended en masse this afternoon at the wedding of the Chevalier Jean Wise de Nolan, Grand High Chief Ranger of the Irish National Foresters, with Miss Fir Conifer of Pine Valley. Lady Sylvester Elmshade, Mrs. Barbara Lovebirch, Mrs. Paul Ash, Mrs. Holly Hazel Eyes, Miss Daphne Bays, Miss Dorothy Canebrick, Mrs. Clyde Twelve Trees, Mrs. Rowan Green, Mrs. Helen Vine Gadding, Miss Virginia Creeper, Miss Gladys Beach, Miss Olive Garth, Miss Blanche Maple, Mrs. Maud Mahogany, Miss Myra Myrtle, Miss Priscilla Elderflower, Miss B. Honeysuckle, Miss Grace Poplar, Miss Omimosa San, Miss Rachel Cedarfrond, the Misses Lillian and Viola Lilac, Miss Timidity Aspinall, Mrs. Kitty Dewey Moss, Miss May Hawthorne, Mrs. Gloriana Palm, Mrs. Leanna Forrest, Mrs. Arabella Blackwood, and Mrs. Norma Holyoke of Oakholme Regis graced the ceremony by their presence. The bride, who was given away by her father, the Maconifer of the Glands, looked exquisitely charming in a creation carried out in green mercerized silk, moulded on an underslip of gloaming grey, sashed with a yoke of broad emerald and finished with a triple flounce of darker-hued fringe, the scheme being relieved by bretelles and hip insertions of acorn bronze. The maids of honour, Miss Larch Conifer and Miss Spruce Conifer, sisters of the bride, wore very becoming costumes in the same tone, a dainty motif of plume rose being worked into the pleats in a pinstripe and repeated capriciously in the jade-green toques in the form of heron feathers of pale-tinted coral. Señor Enrique Flor presided at the organ with his well-known ability and, in addition to the prescribed numbers of the nuptial mass, played a new and striking arrangement of Woodman Spare That Tree at the conclusion of the service. On leaving the Church of St. Fiacre in Horto, after the papal blessing, the happy pair were subjected to a playful crossfire of hazelnuts, beechmast, bay leaves, catkins of willow, ivy tod, holly berries, mistletoe sprigs, and quicken shoots. Mr. and Mrs. Wise Conifer Nolan will spend a quiet honeymoon in the Black Forest.
And our eyes are on Europe, says the citizen. We had our trade with Spain and the French and with the Flemings before those mongrels were pupped. Spanish ale in Galway, the wine bark on the wine dark waterway.
And will again, says Joe.
And with the help of the Holy Mother of God, we will again, says the citizen, clapping his thigh. Our harbours that are empty will be full again. Queenstown, Kinsale, Galway, Black Sod Bay, Ventry in the Kingdom of Kerry, Killybegs, the third largest harbour in the wide world, with a fleet of masts of the Galway Lynches and the Cavan O'Reillys and the O'Kennedys of Dublin, when the Earl of Desmond could make a treaty with the Emperor Charles V himself. And will again, says he, when the first Irish battleship is seen breasting the waves with our own flag to the fore. None of your Henry Tudor's harps, no, the oldest flag afloat, the flag of the province of Desmond and Thomond, three crowns on a blue field, the three sons of Milesius.
And he took the last swig out of the pint.
Moya. All wind and piss like a tanyard cat. Cows in Connaught have long horns. As much as his bloody life is worth to go down and address his tall talk to the assembled multitude in Shanagolden, where he daredn't show his nose with the Molly Maguires looking for him to let daylight through him for grabbing the holding of an evicted tenant. "Hear, hear to that," says John Wise. "What will you have?" "An imperial yeomanry," says Lenehan, "to celebrate the occasion." "Half one, Terry," says John Wise. "And a hands up, Terry. Are you asleep?"
"Yes, sir," says Terry. "Small whiskey and bottle of Allsop. Right, sir."
Hanging over the bloody paper with Alf, looking for spicy bits instead of attending to the general public. Picture of a butting match, trying to crack their bloody skulls. One chap going for the other with his head down like a bull at a gate. And another one, black beast burned in Omaha, Georgia. A lot of Deadwood Dicks in slouch hats, and they firing at a Sambo strung up in a tree with his tongue out and a bonfire under him. God, they ought to drown him in the sea after and electrocute and crucify him to make sure of their job. "But what about the fighting navy," says Ned, "that keeps our foes at bay?"
"I'll tell you what about it," says the citizen. "Hell upon earth it is. Read the revelations that's going on in the papers about flogging on the trading ships at Portsmouth. A feller writes that calls himself Disgusted One."
So he starts telling us about corporal punishment and about the crew of tars and officers and rear admirals drawn up in cocked hats and the parson with his Protestant Bible to witness punishment, and a young lad brought out howling for his ma, and they tie him down on the butt end of a gun.
"A rump and dozen," says the citizen, "was what that old ruffian Sir John Beresford called it. But the modern God's Englishman calls it caning on the breech."
And says John Wise,
"'Tis a custom more honoured in the breech than in the observance."
Then he was telling us the master at arms comes along with a long cane, and he draws out and he flogs the bloody backside off the poor lad till he yells, "Me a murder!"
"That's your glorious British Navy," says the citizen, "that bosses the earth. The fellows that never will be slaves, with the only hereditary chamber on the face of God's earth, and their land in the hands of a dozen game hogs and cotton ball barons. That's the great empire they boast about of drudges and whipped serfs.
On which the sun never rises," says Joe.
"And the tragedy of it is," says the citizen, "they believe it. The unfortunate yahoos believe it."
"They believe in Rod, the Scourger Almighty, creator of hell upon earth, and in Jackie Tar, the son of a gun, who was conceived of unholy boast, born of the fighting navy, suffered under rump and dozen, was scarified, flayed and curried, yelled like bloody hell. The third day he arose again from the bed, steered into haven, sitteth on his beamen till further orders, when he shall come to drudge for a living and be paid."
"But," says Blue, "isn't discipline the same everywhere? I mean, wouldn't it be the same here if you put force against force?" "Didn't I tell you? As true as I'm drinking this porter, if he was at his last gasp, he'd try to downface you, dying was living."
"We'll put force against force," says the citizen. "We have our greater Ireland beyond the sea. They were driven out of home and home in the Black 47. Their mud cabins and sheelings by the roadside were laid low by the battering ram, and the Times rubbed its hands and told the white-livered Saxons there would soon be as few Irish in Ireland as redskins in America. Even the Grand Turk sent us his piastres. But the Sassenach tried to starve the nation at home while the land was full of crops that the British hyenas bought and sold in Rio de Janeiro. Aye, they drove out the peasants in hordes. 20,000 of them died in the coffin ships. But those that came to the land of the free, remember the land of bondage, and they will come again, and with a vengeance. No cravens, the sons of Granuail, the champions of Catlí ní Houlahan.
Perfectly true, says Bloom, but my point was...
We're a long time waiting for that day, citizen, says Ned, since the poor old woman told us that the French were on the sea and landed at Killala.
Aye, says John Wise. We fought for the Royal Stuarts that reneged us against the Williamites and they betrayed us. Remember Limerick and the broken treaty stone? We gave our best blood to France and Spain, the wild geese. Fontenoy, eh? And Sarsfield and O'Donnell, Duke of Tetuan in Spain, and Ulysses Brown of Camas, that was field marshal to Maria Theresa. But what did we ever get for it?
The French, says the citizen. Set of dancing masters.
Do you know what it is? They were never worth a roasted fart to Ireland. Aren't they trying to make an entente cordiale now at Tay Pay's dinner party with perfidious Albion? Firebrands of Europe, and they always were.
Conspoy les Français,
says Lenehan, nobbling his beer.
And as for the Prussians and the Hanoverians, says Joe, haven't we had enough sausage-eating bastards on the throne, from George the Elector down to the German lad and the flatulent old bitch that's dead?
Jesus, I had to laugh at the way he came out with that about the old one with the winkers on her, blind drunk in her royal palace every night of God. Old Vic, with her jorum of Mountain Dew, and her coachman carting her up body and bones to roll into bed, and she pulling him by the whiskers and singing him old bits of songs about Erin on the Rhine and come where the booze is cheaper.
Well, says J.J., we have Edward the Peacemaker now.
Tell that to a fool, says the citizen. There's a bloody sight more pox than pax about that boyo. Edward Guelfetine.
And what do you think, says Joe, of the holy boys, the priests and bishops of Ireland, doing up his room in Maynooth in his satanic majesty's racing colours, and sticking up pictures of all the horses his jockeys rode? The Earl of Dublin, no less.
They ought to have stuck up all the women he rode himself, says little Alf.
And says J.J., considerations of space influenced their lordship's decision.
Will you try another, citizen? Says Joe.
Yes, sir, says he. I will.
You? Says Joe.
Beholden to you, Joe, says I. May your shadow never grow less.
Repeat that dose, says Joe.
Bloom was talking and talking with John Wise, and he quite excited, with his dun, duckety, mud-coloured mug on him, and his old plum eyes rolling about.
Persecution, says he. All the history of the world is full of it, perpetuating national hatred among nations.
But do you know what a nation means? Says John Wise.
Yes, says Bloom.
What is it? Says John Wise.
A nation, says Bloom.
A nation is the same people
living in the same place.
By God then, says Ned, laughing, if that's so, I'm a nation, for I'm living in the same place for the past 5 years.
So, of course, everyone had the laugh at Bloom, and says he, trying to muck out of it, or also living in different places.
That covers my case, says Joe.
What is your nation, if I may ask? Says the citizen.
Ireland, says Bloom. I was born here.
Ireland.
The citizen said nothing, only cleared the spit out of his gullet, and gob, he spat a red bank oyster out of him right in the corner.
After you with the push, Joe, says he,
taking out his handkerchief to swab himself dry.
Here you are, citizen, says Joe. Take that in your right hand and repeat after me the following words.
The much-treasured and intricately embroidered ancient Irish face-cloth, attributed to Solomon of Droma and Manus Tomaltoch Og MacDonach, authors of the Book of Ballymote, was then carefully produced and called forth prolonged admiration. No need to dwell on the legendary beauty of the corner pieces, the acme of art, wherein one can distinctly discern each of the four evangelists in turn, presenting to each of the four masters his evangelical symbol, a bog oak sceptre, a North American puma, a far nobler king of beasts than the British article, be it said in passing, a Kerry calf and a golden eagle from Carron Tuhill. The scenes depicted on the Amunctory field, showing our ancient duns and raths and cromlechs and greenhorns and seats of learning and maledictive stones, are as wonderfully beautiful and the pigments as delicate as when the Sligo illuminators gave free rein to their artistic fantasy long, long ago in the time of the Barmecides. Glendalough, the lovely lakes of Killarney, the ruins of Clanmacnoise, Cong Abbey, Glen Ina, and the 12 Pins, Ireland's Eye, the green hills of Tallaght, Croke Patrick, the brewery of Messrs. Arthur Guinness Son and Company Limited, Loch Ness Banks, the Vale of Avoca, Isolt's Tower, the Mappus Obelisk, Sir Patrick Dunn's Hospital, Cape Clear, the Glen of Aholow, Lynch's Castle, the Scotch House, Rathdown Union Workhouse at Loughlinstown, Tullamore Jail, Castle Connell Rapids, Kilbally MacShonachill, the Cross at Monaster Boyce, Jury's Hotel, St. Patrick's Purgatory, the Salmon Leap, Maynooth College Refectory, Curly's Hole, the three birthplaces of the first Duke of Wellington, the Rock of Cashel, the Bog of Allen, the Henry Street Warehouse, Fingal's Cave. All these moving scenes are still there for us today, rendered more beautiful still by the waters of sorrow which have passed over them, and by the rich incrustations of time.
This ends Disc 18.